This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm Susie Ahn, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Time to look back at the last 7 days and make sense of the biggest local and state stories in our weekly news recap. From the assassination attempt to former President Donald Trump.
Let me begin this evening by expressing my gratitude to the American people for your outpouring of love and support following the assassination attempt at my rally on Saturday.
To all the news coming out of the Republican National Convention.
Illinois proudly cast all 64 votes for President Donald J. Trump.
And updates from Chicago's City Council.
A new hate crime ordinance passed in City Council today. It means Chicago police will issue hefty fines for hate littering.
To dive deep into those headlines and more, I sat down with Justin Lawrence, government and politics reporter at Crane's Chicago Business, Chicago Tribune investigative reporter Ray Long, and Alex Degman, State House reporter for WBEZ. Alex has been up in Milwaukee this week covering the Republican National Convention, so I started by asking about his main takeaways.
It was a very long week, but my main takeaways, I've got a couple. One of them is that the Illinois Republican Party, for all intents and purposes, is united behind Donald Trump. And that means a couple of things. Number one, they went to the convention united, and they put a united front behind the former president, which was the main reason they went there. But also, it kicked off some conversations. It kicked off a lot of conversations that had been percolating for a while about, now that we are united behind former President Trump, what does that mean for the future of the state party? Because as you know, President Trump, if you look at the numbers statewide, not very popular. He hasn't done very well here. And Republicans know that, but they also know that they are shifting to the right. This is what the national headwinds are saying, and that's kind of where they're trying to go. So the question that they have is, how do we do that with the candidates that we want to put up in a state like Illinois?
Yeah, it sounded like there was a lot of hope that they could pick up some seats. Well, Ray, Justin, what stood out for both of you from this week's convention?
Well, last night's speech by Trump was remarkable in length, for sure. But what was really interesting is that he could have had a short speech, very emotional, focused as he did focus, and gave a good presentation right off the bat about the harrowing moment when he was shot at last Saturday. And then he did that, he pulled it off, and he could have said a couple of wrap-up things, vote for me, or make America great again, and then walked off the stage, and he probably would have been heralded as one of the biggest moments of the convention. However, he went into a quiet version of American carnage, ticking off a lot of his greatest hits, hailing dictators like the one in North Korea and Orban, and he just could not give it up. And even though he didn't pound on the table and scream and kind of adopted a similar strategy to his debate strategy, where he was more toned down, he vamped for so long and ad-libbed for so long through his greatest or worst hits, depending on your view. that it detracted from his overall ability to energize people. Now, in that room, I would say, Alex would probably agree that I wasn't there and Alex was, but I would say that everybody is, you know, four square behind him. But he could have done a lot better for himself if he'd performed better.
I think it was, they recorded it as the longest modern history.
Yeah, 93 minutes.
And Ray, I can say, being on the floor for the entire speech, people were bored. There were some people, especially toward the back where I was standing. There were points where people would stand up and wave their signs and applaud. But, you know, if it were a short, more truncated speech, like you were saying, it could have been a lot more powerful. People could have been really ramped up. But instead, a lot of people were looking at their phones. They were sitting down. People got bored after a little while, especially with the tone.
Yeah, I get that impression, too. Yeah.
What about you, Justin? Any takeaways?
Well, to Ray's point, I think after the assassination attempt, they were attempting to soften, the GOP was attempting to soften their message. Mm-hmm. And that speech almost kind of served as the transition, right? He started that way, but that's not how he ended. It was one of those moments again where some in the media say, hey, we see a new Trump. He's presidential. You know, that's what they used to say back in 2016. But, you know, that is not his message. His message is America is a terrible place and I alone can fix it. And that's kind of how he pivoted. And then my other takeaway was on the opposite side, right? The DNC Democrats were tempered in their responses to the speeches and their criticism of the GOP. And, you know, this week did not go how Democrats wanted, right? They wanted to use this week to hammer the message that Republicans are radicals and we can't trust them. And instead, they were much more measured in their comments.
Yeah, and I absolutely want to get to that. But first, before we do that, I wanted to know about the security there, Alex. And I know this was your first time covering a convention, but was there any sense that there was heightened security after Saturday's assassination attempt?
Yes. And you're right. This is the first national convention I've covered. I don't know what security is typically like, but some of the folks that I talked to initially said that, that this is a lot more intense than it usually is. But at the same time, and I noticed this too, it was really well run, at least around the convention itself. There were a couple of perimeters and there were only a couple of ingress and egress points. I don't know if I'm using those words properly, but so there were pretty big lines, at least on the first couple of days to get in. I think the first time I tried to get in, it took 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, once I got there, you know, got up to the checkpoint, turned off the car, opened the hood, all that stuff. And it was a very detailed search with dogs and all that. And then once you get inside the convention area, it's kind of a ghost town. Like there aren't a whole lot of cars because it's limited access. There aren't a whole lot of people aside from delegates and people who were supposed to be there. So it seemed safe because there wasn't like the only people around were delegates, reporters, politicians, mm-hmm. and police.
But it wasn't without issue. I know that law enforcement was brought in from surrounding states to help out. Police from Ohio ended up fatally shooting a man near the convention. What are the details on that, Alex?
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot of the details, but what I can say is that there were some police officers, based on the video that I saw, there were some police officers from Columbus, and they were in an area near the convention site, probably about a mile away or so, and it looked like there were two people who were fighting in the street, and the Columbus police officers on video, the video cuts out before the actual shooting occurs, but it looks like they just fired at these people that were fighting in the street. I don't know what led to the officers getting involved. I don't know why they got involved, but it wasn't really an issue for the convention to continue because the security in the convention, I mean, if people, I doubt that a lot of people inside the area even knew that it happened because if the only way that you would know that it happened is if you were outside the perimeter paying attention to local news and things like that. So, it was definitely a scene for sure.
Well, some of the local reports, Susie, said that there were the one guy who was shot had a couple of weapons, knives, two knives, or and that he was looked like to police that he was lunging at the other person, and therefore they they intervened in a way that has gotten a lot of criticism. But the mayor of Milwaukee has viewed it as justifiable, their approach. And so obviously the family of the victim or the person who was shot and died, they feel differently about it. Yeah. So we've always got one of those kinds of things that has to be sorted out.
Yeah, the investigation continues on that one for sure. Well, you know, going back to the point that you were making earlier, Justin, you know, Democrats also made some changes because of what happened last Saturday. Governor Pritzker was scheduled to be in Milwaukee on Monday, but changed course. Fill us in on some of the changes that Illinois Democrats had to make.
Well, yeah, you just touched on it. The biggest change was Governor Pritzker going up there. You know, Pritzker is a huge national voice right now, a top surrogate for Joe Biden. He's spoken at various state Democratic Party luncheons and events. So not having him there was a big deal. They've just had to, I guess, temper their message, right? They haven't completely. Governor Pritzker was asked about this, not obviously not in Milwaukee, but at an unrelated press conference here, and he said, the shooting attempt does not change the fact that Trump is a convicted felon and that he incited violence and that he would be bad for working people. So they haven't completely gone away from their message. I think they were just trying to seem above the fray, maybe this earlier this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough situation for Democrats, having to change their messaging and strategy after last Saturday's shooting. But do you think this plan, this strategy is working so far?
Well, it's tough to tell. I mean, they've got a long haul ahead of them. And as we record this show, there are news reports out that Biden is ready to campaign next week. So that goes against the grain of a lot of people who are calling for him to step down and be replaced on the ticket. And therefore, the Democrats still have this level of chaos that nobody can really tell where they're going. And that's not a good position to be in.
Well, while our current Democratic governor decided not to go to Milwaukee, a former Democratic Illinois governor did make the trip. Ray, what was Rod Blagojevich doing in Milwaukee?
You know, I covered him for many years, and it was always difficult to tell what Rod Blagojevich was doing. But this time he went up there as a member of Serbs. He's Serbian. His ethnic background is Serbian. So he was Serbs for Trump. And of course, you know, he was convicted, sent to prison for 14 years on a variety of things, including trying to sell Barack Obama's vacated U.S. Senate seat when Obama won the White House. And Trump then commuted. He did not pardon, but he commuted Blagojevich's prison term to roughly the 8 years he had served. And Rod has been eternally grateful and has declared himself a Trumpocrat and still is as difficult to understand where he's coming from as always.
Well, another Chicagoan made an appearance at the RNC. Alex Southside pastor Corey Brooks gave the closing prayer at the convention on Tuesday. Tell us about Corey Brooks' role there at the convention.
Well, Corey Brooks was there as part of one of the themes of the convention, which was Make America Safe Again. And Corey Brooks is one of those folks in Chicago who has been, obviously he's known as locally as the rooftop pastor. He's been on the forefront of community safety issues for a very long time. And he also supports President Trump. And he was there just to, he was the keynote on the evening that they talked about public safety. And to be fair, I wasn't in the room when Corey Brooks was giving his keynote address. But, as far as I can tell, and Ray, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was the only speaker from Illinois.
You know, you would have a better handle. I don't know that for sure. I think that's an excellent point. I mean, he certainly had a bigger platform than than any others. Blagojevich was the one who was drawing the headlines, as well as Mary Miller, who headed or took a major role in the delegation.
Well, speaking of, oh, sorry, Justin.
I was just going to say, as a City Hall denizen reporter, I thought I should mention that concerned citizen George Blakemore was also spotted up there. He, of course, did not speak, but I saw some pictures floating around of him. He is a frequent and combative public speaker at City Hall.
Yes, indeed. Not surprised that he made it up there. Well, speaking of Mary Miller, we had all those storms hit the Midwest earlier this week, and we're having all sorts of extreme weather across the country. And we still have climate change skeptics, including the leader of Illinois 64 member delegation to the Republican National Convention, Congresswoman Mary Miller. Here are her thoughts on what she calls the, quote, communist environmental movement.
And thank you also for bringing up the communist environmental movement, the Green Bag Deal that Donald Trump has called out as a sham issue. And I want to tell you, as a farmer, we love CO2, and trees and plants love it too. They have demonized the miracle molecule that causes things to grow. And the people behind this environmental sham are becoming wildly enriched.
Ray, Representative Miller has been a close Trump ally. She attended his hush money trial in New York City. Could you see her playing a more prominent role in a possible second Trump administration?
Well, I think she'll get more traction if Trump is reelected, because she has been aligned with him so closely and has tried to get him to tighten his relationship with her. I mean, he even came in and endorsed her when she ran against a longtime congressman when they got redistricted together. And so she has been a supporter, again, one of these people who's all behind Trump, and that's the kind of person he likes.
Well, switching a little bit to some of the drama, not really big news, but some of the drama that took place at the RNC. Another member of Illinois' Republican delegation made headlines for confronting Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz. Alex, what was that about?
That was our committeeman, Richard Porter. He was caught on camera basically standing behind Matt Gaetz as Matt Gaetz was interrupting a live TV interview with Speaker Johnson. It was a former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. That's mm-hmm. who it was. Sorry about that. And Porter was not real happy with Matt Gaetz and basically said a couple of expletives Gaetz way and said, "Don't be a jerk." That's a toned down way of saying it. Like, don't be a jerk. Gaetz turned around, said, "I don't know who you are." And Porter said, "Okay, that's fine, but don't be a jerk." And that's pretty much what it was. And the reason that it made headlines, at least in Illinois political circles, that went crazy because Illinois Congressman Mike Bost, and this is part of it, Illinois Congressman Mike Bost, when the speaker fight was going on, was rumored to be in the room telling Matt Gaetz to sit down, to know his role and things like that. So when that happened, it kind of reignited some of the conversations amongst state Republicans and amongst political watchers. Are they really trying to unify behind Donald Trump? Like, are the establishment Republicans really getting in line behind this? And it was fodder for a little while, but then he told our colleagues at the Sun-Times it's kind of for show. And I know that I probably went about it the wrong way, but yes, we're a united front, and let's get to work.
Well, but that exchange between Gaetz and McCarthy before he stepped in, right, also undercut the idea of a united national Republican Party, right? That all of our disputes are behind us, and we're all 100% behind President Trump, or former President Trump.
Yeah, there's only so far they'll go with crazy, so that's kind of the problem they have in balancing the whole unified front.
Yeah, well, I mean, speaking about being unified, Alex, the Illinois GOP recently chose a new leader. Tell us more about her.
OK, Kathy Salvey is a longtime Illinois Republican. You might know her most recently from running for U.S. Senate against Tammy Duckworth in 2022. She ran on a very conservative platform. She is staunchly anti-abortion, and she has, you know, similar views that you might expect. And she is kind of acting as what I would call a bridge candidate for the Republican Party. She is like she's well liked by a lot of people, but I get the idea that she's going to fill out the rest of outgoing Chairman Don Tracy's term, and then they're going to see where they're at. She is, like I said, she is well liked by both the establishment and the grassroots, and her challenge is going to be how to bring both of them together. And what I hear from Republicans, especially because they're happy that she's there, they're happy that someone like her has the job, and they are, and I would say that they are just kind of excited to see what she might bring to the table when they look for candidates to run in 26. That was one of the questions I tried to ask quite a bit, that with how the party is, they don't really know the answer to right now.
Right. Well, before we head to break, I want to get this last bit about conventions in. So Chicago, of course, is preparing for next month's Democratic convention. Mayor Johnson is denying residents were removed from a downtown shelter to make room for unhoused people moved out of an encampment along the Dan Ryan. Justin, what are the details there?
Yeah, so this is I'm sure everybody who's driven past that has seen it for quite some time. It's been there for a long time. This week, they moved residents out of there, out of the homeless encampment. And some of them, not all of them, were given spaces at a hotel in Streeterville or River North, maybe. And the Sun-Times reported that to make way for them, some existing residents of that shelter were moved out. And what was notable about this, not just the action, but there was a mixed message coming out of City Hall, right? Mayor Brandon Johnson at his post-City Council press conference denied that it had anything to do with the DNC, that this is part of our efforts to support people. It's ongoing. It will continue to happen. A day before, an administration official with DFSS, Department of Family Support Services, said they said it in a strange way. Maybe this is like us anticipating that the Secret Service might have security concerns with this encampment. So we're taking action now to remove them so that we wouldn't have to do it in a kind of hasty way closer to the DNC. That still means it's directly related to the DNC coming. And the mayor disputes that. And it's kind of, I don't know that he has a leg to stand on there.
Yeah, it does not sound like they've resolved it either. It sounds like it's just an ongoing mess until, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
There was plenty of news in Chicago City Council this week, particularly when it comes to zoning. Let's start with the mayor's attempt to get a progressive ally to head up the powerful zoning committee. Justin, will you fill us in on that?
Yeah, so this has been a long brewing melodrama at City Hall that kicked off late last year. I believe it was in November when the former chair, Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who's kind of a stalwart of local progressives, a close ally of the mayor, he stepped aside as chair after a very combative meeting where he kind of physically got in between Alderman Emma Mitz, one of the oldest aldermen on the council, and prevented her from blocking or coming into a meeting in an attempt to thwart a vote that the mayor opposed. And since then, it's been without a permanent chair. Alderman Bennett Lawson, a freshman, has acted as vice chair, and the mayor just really hasn't been able to get the votes to install someone new. He's kind of pigeonholed himself in that he promised the Latino caucus that it would remain a Latino member of the council that would have the chair. And a lot of them are freshmen who don't typically get put in leadership. Some of them are way too relatively conservative for the mayor to appoint them. So he's landed on Alderman Byron Sigcho Lopez, who's a very close ally to him, but he's also a pretty combative alderman, has, I would say, poor relationships with some of his colleagues. And to kind of help smooth things over, Cito Lopez was coming from the Housing Committee, and Johnson was going to appoint Alderman Walter Burnett, the longest-serving alderman, has great relationships with most of the city council, as that chair. But amid some questions about the way they were doing this, just some nitty-gritty parliamentary rules that people were objecting to. The mayor withdrew the didn't withdraw the nomination, but withdrew the plan to do it this week. And it does seem like they're going to try to run this back next week. I didn't check this morning. I believe that meeting is going to be on Thursday, but it hasn't officially been scheduled yet. But we'll see. He'll need 26 votes. It appeared this week that he would have it, but usually if you have the votes, you call it for a vote, and you do it when the iron's hot. So it'll be really interesting next
week. Yeah, who seems to be leading the revolt against Alderman Sergio Lopez's nomination?
Well, this week, Alderman Brendan Riley, he was the one kind of leading the parliamentary, we're going to question the way you're doing this. But so a couple months ago, Byron Sergio Lopez spoke at a rally after a flag had been burned, American flag had been burned. And there was a movement within city council to strip him of his housing committee chair. It failed. I believe there were 16 votes against him. So that's plenty of supporters, right? But I imagine those same 16 votes will also oppose him going to zoning.
Right. I mean, it's no surprise that Sergio Lopez does not have a lot of fans within the council. Ray, is it surprising that Mayor Johnson would select him for something as important as the head of the zoning committee? I mean, was this maybe a stumble in strategy on his part?
Well, yeah, I think that's a consistent thread in some of his administrative moves here. I think Justin made a good point where he's boxed in now because he needs to find a Hispanic, since he's made a promise or a vow to keep that seat Hispanic. And so you go with the best choice of selection that he must not feel has many to offer. And so he's forcing folks to make a choice, and they haven't lined up for him yet. And it's a new kind of dynamic in a council that we have often seen as a lapdog. And so now that we've heard from citizens complain over the years that the city council ought to have more voice rather than just bow down to whatever the mayor wants, you see that it can cause a lot of great consternation and confusion.
Yeah. Well, in addition to deferring a vote on Alderman Sergio Lopez's leadership, the zoning committee also deferred a vote for the second month in a row on a controversial Sterling Bay project in Lincoln Park. Justin, what are the details there?
Yeah, so this is a two-tower building, with the larger tower being 25 stories. And Alderman Scott Wagesback, he's the local alderman of that ward, he opposes the project, says 25 stories is way too high, we need to come down. He's floated 15. I don't know if he has a set number he would agree to, right? But so this touches that ongoing thing at City Hall is aldermanic prerogative. Council members defer to the local colleague, especially on zoning in their wards. And traditionally, not much gets approved unless the local alderman supports it. Mayor Brendan Johnson has, at least on this project, signaled he's willing to try to tackle that. It did get a vote in the Plan Commission, which is kind of it's a zoning approval commission, but it's all appointed by the mayor, and it's usually kind of a rubber stamp. I know they are upset that I just said that right now, but he's shown he's willing to push this project forward. But for 2 months now, the developer Sterling Bay has asked for it not to come up for a vote. I think the hope is the city council takes an August recess. Now we're in September. Maybe the tension has calmed down and we can eventually hold a vote, even though I don't think there's going to be a compromise with Wagesback.
Well, turning to Chicago's Zoning Board of Appeals, two Johnson appointees did get city council approval. But before we talk about the appointees, Justin, what exactly is the Zoning Board of Appeals? What authority does it have?
Oh, man, now we're right in my dorky wheelhouse. I love it. So the Zoning Board of Appeals, They approve a lot of very local things like driveway permits. Some of the most combative things is, someone wants to build a walkway from their second floor of their house to their garage. And you wouldn't believe the fights that that touches off in the Zoning Board of Appeals. But they also do some larger things. They approve homelessness shelters or transitional shelters. They need a special use permit for that, and they have to go before the ZBA. But for all of Johnson's term until now, it has been understaffed or underrepresented. There's a 5-person commission, and they've only had 4. Twice it's dropped down to 3. And what that means is you have to receive 3 votes and approval to get anything done. And so the most controversial things are the things that neighborhoods are opposing have been held back because the zoning attorneys are advising their clients, hey, I'm worried that it's going to be really hard to get a unanimous vote here. It blocked a homelessness shelter in Uptown back in, I believe that vote happened in February. And that kind of led to this, right? Like the mayor put forward 2 people and then another person stepped down. So he put forward another person and that nomination was blocked by, in part by Alderman Angel Clay, who does represent Uptown. There were others who were also upset because that appointee, when they were a alternate, was cast one of the votes against the homeless shelter. And now, instead, she withdrew her nomination, and Helen Schiller, who Ray probably has more experience with than I do, long-time Uptown alderman, she was often, you know, she was the sole vote. Ray was talking about a rubber stamp council. I mean, Richard M. Daley was passing budgets 49-1, and often Helen Schiller was the lone vote against it.
And then the other appointee is a lawyer with Metropolitan YMCA.
Yes, Swathi Staley. And, you know, it was interesting when they go before the zoning committee to explain themselves or explain why they should be on the board. And Helen Schiller was definitely, hey, I am an alderman. I know the role you guys play in your wards. I will be deferential to you. Staley, you know, she said some of those, but she was much more lawyerly. And talked about her, you know, experience in the community.
Well, continuing with city council, drivers might have to slow down if one alderman has his way. Justin, I've got a pun here. Can you get us up to speed on that?
Oh man, that's good. Yeah, so this would, you know, currently the default citywide speed limit is 30 miles per hour. It's posted lower or higher in some parts of the city, but the default would be lowered to 25. And the reasoning behind that is it would save lives, right? There is, I can't cite the exact data, but the CDOT regularly testified to this, that hey, the impact at 20 miles per hour or 25 miles per hour, just it saves X amount of lives versus if that car is going 30 miles per hour. But, you know, if it's something that saves lives and it's that easy, it would have been done decades ago or years ago. So it will be interesting to see where this goes. This was just introduced this week. So it'll be something that plays out in the fall.
Well, it applies to bikes too, because they're whizzing by me left and right as it happens.
Yeah. Those e-bikes I do think e-bikes are, they have to be, if the e-bike can go above, I believe it's 27 miles per hour,
they're not paying
then they're not classified anyway as bikes anymore. Yeah. They can't be in the bike lane.
Ray, the reason that bikes are whizzing by you, and I can't really go faster than 25 on a lot of city streets anyway, so that could be why.
Well, I mean, another proposal there is that Chicagoans would be able to submit photos of cars violating bus and bike lanes. I mean, Ray, Alex, what do you think of that?
It just so happens that I have a former boss/manager who would be very, very happy with that. You know, he's one of those Twitter people who takes pictures of cars blocking bike lanes and making a big deal out of it. So, yeah, I can imagine that would gain a lot of traction around here with a certain group of people.
And then before we had to break, another city council law establishes hefty fines for hate littering. Justin, fill us in on the details.
Yeah, so this is in response. This was Alderman Timmy Knudsen, who represents most all of Lincoln Park. There was a kind of a flyering incident and some sort of vial or something that had some sort of substance in it that had people really concerned. It was anti-Jewish flyering, anti-Semitic flyering up there. And he's been working on this for quite a while now. It was, I don't know if it's right to say it was stalled, but the Department of Law, you know, was definitely going over the language to make sure that this did, it did what it intended to do without violating people's First Amendment rights, which is protected even if that speech is pretty terrible sometimes, right? So this would impose up to $1,000 fines if the flyer or message that's kind of distributed on cars or mailboxes is deemed threatening. I know that they worked hard on this, but it does seem like it is ripe for a First Amendment challenge, and Alderman Knutson is satisfied with it and believes they wrote it in a way that it would survive that, but that would be for a court to decide.
I mean, it's interesting because there's no victim or hate speech is protected. So what sort of messages or materials would be banned under this ordinance?
So, you know, like flyers that get put on every car door on a street, stickers that get posted all over a community.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
We're going to get an update on former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. His corruption trial is supposed to start in October, but his lawyers are trying to get many of the charges dropped, citing a recent Supreme Court decision. Ray, what's the latest?
Well, it's real interesting here because this is classic Mike Madigan. He's put together a major offense on his defense, and he's tried to knock out 14 of the 23 counts. A lot of those are fatally flawed, he says, and that is because they are using this new Supreme Court decision that came out of Portage, Indiana. That's the one where the mayor there steered a couple of contracts to a garbage truck company, and then a few weeks later went over to that company, asked for a job, and they gave him a consulting, quote-unquote, contract in which he got $13,000 and barely had anything to do. And so the Supreme Court said that because there wasn't a quid pro quo that was clear and upfront, that is not bribery. It had been considered bribery, and the Portage mayor had been convicted of bribery. So this opened up an enormous gaping hole in how prosecutors can go forward with bribery cases. Now, if the gratuity comes in after the fact, it's basically off the boards now. So in a lot of these cases, Madigan has argued that either the direct charge or the specific charges that surround other charges really undercut the government's case. And so it's going to be he's taking kind of the lead role in attacking what now can be prosecuted as as of this new Supreme Court decision. It's going to be very interesting. He's a guy who always, when he was in the legislature, he always tried to win before the game was played. And so if he could knock somebody off the ballot before people went to vote, he'd do that. But this is a very similar pattern to his long and involved and very intense career.
Yes, Madigan is not short of strategy for sure. What do you think is the likelihood we might see some of these charges dropped?
Well, you know, it's always impossible for me to get into a judge's mind. But I do think that the prosecutors are going to have to retailor their approach. They can keep the counts intact and try to argue different avenues within those counts. But the judge may come around and say, no, they're completely wiped out. And at least five to seven could be impacted right off the bat. Still, there were 23 counts overall in the case. And so it ranges from ComEd, racketeering, to AT&T, involving putting cronies on the payroll of those utilities that are state regulated, to steering contracts, legal work to Madigan crony. And the one that is most curious is that Madigan pushed for ComEd to put his choice on their board of directors. Wow. And they did it.
Yeah. Is it bribery or is it gratuity? Well, sticking with state politics, after being a bit of an obstacle to a publicly funded stadium, Governor Pritzker met with Bears President Kevin Warren this week. Justin, do we have any idea what came out of that meeting?
I don't think a lot came out of it, at least for now. You know, both sides somewhat downplayed the meeting, but it was significant in the sense that Governor Pritzker, when all of this was percolating in the spring, kept his distance. He purposely, right? He didn't want to meet with the Bears at the time because it gave credence to their plan, I believe. The Bears did have a meeting with his staff that he was very much not at, right? And so this is why it's significant. It's after the drama played out. There's no timeline. There's no deadline right now on the decision. Remember, they were trying at some point to get something done in the spring ahead of the General Assembly closing up their session. So now it was described as a get to know you meeting, yeah. Right? The stadium was discussed, and I don't think this drama is over, right? As we get closer to the November veto session, that's where we'll start to see whether the Bears have changed their plan.
Yeah. Well, Alex, were you at all surprised to hear that the governor met with the head of the Bears?
Not really. I think that the governor has always said that he's willing to listen. And if it's going to be a good deal, I don't know what that means, but if it's going to be a good deal for taxpayers, then he'll consider it. So I think he recognizes the importance of having the Bears in the city of Chicago, at least in the area, because of the economic engine that it is and the ties that we have to it. So I think he's always willing to listen, but it's going to be, I still think it's going to be really hard for the team to extract any kind of resources at all from the state, you know, aside from maybe some infrastructure help here and there.
Yeah. Well, shifting gears here, pro-Palestinian protests have somewhat died down as local college students left for the summer. However, this week we saw decisions come in on disciplining protesters. Ray, what happened at Northwestern?
Right. They filed misdemeanors in this activity that was like 2 months old. And they didn't give a whole lot of details, but the people who were charged basically had interfered more than the rest of the people who encamped there. You know, Northwestern actually cut a deal and got them to decamp pretty quickly, as opposed to other universities that had long and crazy conflicts. But this is one where they decided to lay down the law on four particular people. And they waited until the whole issue had pretty much moved out of the headlines and waited for a day when former president of the United States was going to be sucking up a lot of the oxygen in the news cycle.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting timing there. Well, sticking with that theme, an off-duty Chicago police officer is facing a 10-day suspension for marching in a pro-Palestinian demonstration. Justin, why is he being disciplined?
Well, he apparently was at these at several protests, one where a Sun-Times reporter photographer had, you know, he was included in his rounds of photography from that event, and this officer was identified, and he was wearing his CPD-issued uniform, not the regular uniform. I think it was more of like a special operations uniform. But, you know, the CPD has rules against that, rules against even off-duty engaging in political activity while representing the CPD, in this instance, representing them by wearing the uniform. I don't know, actually, if he's trying to contest this, but this has happened before, and it does seem a pretty up and down issue.
We've seen that in what 2017 or so, when a couple of officers took a knee following Colin Kaepernick. Turning to another, I don't even know what to call it, a controversy this week. It was sort of, when I read this story, I was a little like, so who's mad? There was some controversy this week involving a statue of one of the nation's founding fathers. Ray, what was going on with this statue at City Hall?
Yeah, there's a statue of George Washington that was put there, I think, in 1984. I could be wrong on that, but Justin, correct me.
Yeah, you're right, by former mayor Harold
Washington. So it was put out there by Harold Washington, the first black mayor of Chicago. And there were conflicting signals coming out of the mayor's office and his staff about, well, they're going to move that and maybe just put another statue, maybe Ida B. Wells or somebody else who has greater ties here to Chicago. And then that became a controversy. You're throwing out the first president of the United States. Is it because he had slaves? You know, are you considering that the time that was going on and the whole culture at that moment? And by the end of the day, they were talking about, well, maybe we won't do it, and
it wasn't really to do like renovations or something.
And it wasn't Lori Lightfoot's fault. So it was just kind of another one of those head scratchers that you go, what are they doing over there?
Right. Well, before we let you go, in just the couple of minutes we have left, really quickly, what stories will you all be watching next week? Ray, we'll start with you.
Oh, man, if I told you, then, you know, I'd be violating some big secret. So,
all right, so we'll be on the lookout for a big story from Ray next week. Alex, what about you?
I actually might still be covering the RNC next week. There are a lot of threads to pull. Yeah. I guess we say, and just kind of following up on some angles that I didn't get to touch on this week.
All right, Justin.
I mean, certainly the will he or won't he, will President Joe Biden step aside, yep, is the one we're all watching. But then I get to go back to city council next week because we're going to do this whole zoning chair vote all over again.
Oh, my goodness. More of that. Well, that's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Justin Lawrence of Crane's Chicago Business, Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune, and WBEZ's Alex Degman. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Micah Yasin. In less than an hour, we break down the top stories you need to know. But if you want a few updates throughout the week, sign up for our newsletter. It comes out on Mondays and Fridays, and you can subscribe at wbez.org/reset. I'm Susie Ahn, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue, as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.